Shiba shiba.
Let me in.
Shiba shiba.
I wanna be closer to you.
Shiba shiba.
Open up your soul.
Shiba shiba.
Let me find that part of you. The part that nobody ever knew.
Let me touch your.
Hello and welcome to Let Me Touch Your Mind, the show where we try to get you to be something, do something, experience something, enjoy something, or, if it's the first Monday of the month, understand something. It's a brand new year. Your mind is fresh and clean, just waiting for somebody to get their grubby little fingerprints all over it and fill it with brand new knowledge. And I've got someone here from Wonderfest organization. They've been helping us out for years, providing us with science envoys. And my science envoy du jour is Natalie LeBaron. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, Natalie, before we get into the actual science of it, can you tell me a little bit about how you got involved with science? Like, when did you first realize that you liked science?
Oh, really have to go back for that.
Mm-hmm.
Feel like it was, 3 years old, I wanted to be some kind of scientist.
Well, what was your understanding at three of what a scientist was?
Well, I guess that developed a lot over my career until now, but mm-hmm. I guess it really stems back from my mom. She was a nurse.
Uh-huh.
I think at like 3 or 4, something like that, really young, I just wanted to learn everything I could about medicine and about, being a doctor, mm-hmm. healing people, and that's what I wanted to be for most of my childhood.
So when you were three, do you even remember your mom explaining things to you? Or would she say a lot of like, oh, it's a little bit complicated?
I think she always tried to explain things. But, different. Or maybe I didn't always grasp exactly what she was trying to tell me
mm-hmm.
every time.
So you started out just deciding, okay, I want to be a nurse. Your mom
doctor.
Oh, okay. And so your mom's like, yeah, that's my baby. So yeah. Do you remember the first time that your mom told you something that just captured your imagination and just sort of solidified that love of science?
That's a good question. I don't know if I remember something in detail from that young. I know as I got older, mm-hmm. I knew I wanted to do science mm-hmm. in some fashion.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't really like math for the longest time, so
okay.
I felt like my home was in biology, medicine, those sorts of things.
Oh,
where,
okay.
Maybe I didn't have to, or I thought that it was less math focused, but I loved learning about the natural world.
Mm-hmm.
I loved going to science museums, and my parents, I feel really fortunate they really encouraged those interests and took me places. My mom got me her anatomy textbooks.
Ooh.
And would let me read them. Not that I necessarily understood all that much.
But you probably just stared at them for hours and hours. And
mm-hmm.
did you remember this is the, duodenum, like...
Yeah, I loved learning about the different organ systems
mm-hmm.
and how everything went together and, how your immune system protected you from all these different diseases and stuff like that and kept my interest up.
So then when you go to school, would you say that the science that you learned in school furthered that, or was it things outside of school that furthered that?
Well, I had sort of non-traditional school, especially through elementary, middle school. So most of that was really my parents giving me different opportunities, which I feel so fortunate that they provided me.
You say non-traditional. Were you homeschooled? Or?
Yeah, for the most part.
Okay. So they ran with that science stuff. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So when you made the transition from homeschooling to the public school system, at what point was that? Was that in college or did it start earlier?
Well, I started taking classes not from my parents in like 8th grade high school, so that's sort of where I see that transition, but I was still mostly taking online classes.
Oh, online class. Oh, that's right. You're you're the new generation where you can do that. Oh, that's pretty great. So then do you go on to a traditional university?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and then when did you start? Because you were saying you wanted to be a doctor,
mm-hmm.
but like a medical doctor.
Yeah.
And you're not you're studying science, space. Mm-hmm. So what was it that shifted your focus?
Yeah, I really have to give credit to my 8th grade physics teacher for that.
Okay.
Something, you know, I took his class in 8th grade and had a really hard time with it, but also found it really fascinating. And he really encouraged me even when I was struggling.
Mm-hmm.
I'd also started to like math a lot more by that point. I had some really good teachers and I don't know, things just started to make sense for me finally. So, you know, more math heavy sciences like physics weren't that scary anymore. Mm-hmm. And from that experience, I guess it just really inspired me, and I wanted to, or I went into high school with the thought that, well, you know, maybe I'll give it a try, see how I feel. I can always, you know, switch out and, you know, do med school for grad work or something like that.
And your trajectory is different from us because usually girls' interest in math tends to fall off around junior high, and I think they attribute it to just the way that girls in school get sort of treated differently in terms of the sciences. So I love that yours, you flipped it. It's like you go into school, and, I love math now.
Mm-hmm.
So did it surprise your folks that suddenly you, or they were just oh, thank goodness somebody figured it out because we couldn't do it.
I think they were happy for me.
Okay.
I was the only one for them, so they just tried to encourage my interests wherever they could, and I'm really thankful that they had that sort of time and space to devote to me and my education.
Okay. So you go into college, you're taking all kinds of physics classes, and, you know, math and physics sort of go together, and because those all build up to space. You need all of that stuff. So at what point did it gel? This is it. This is what I want to do.
Yeah. Well, I knew I was either going to do some sort of medicine or astronomy, basically.
Okay. Uh-huh.
Very different fields, but those are the two things I'm still interested in. Sort of focused just on astronomy at this point.
Okay.
And well, you know, when I started college, I was interested in maybe, you know, at least trying out research and seeing how that felt, how I liked it, what kind of opportunities I could find.
Mm-hmm.
And fortunately, I was lucky enough to get a research position in my first year in undergrad. I'd also done some small little things in high school. Like I went up to Lick Observatory in high school, which was one of the most fantastic experiences I could have had as a high school student. That really opened my eyes to, like, you know, it's this big research observatory that's just up in the hills of San Jose on Mount Hamilton.
Mm-hmm.
Beautiful old observatory. Unfortunately, there just had some big wind damage over Christmas. Now the public part is closed while they try and do renovations.
Sure.
It's really awful.
Yeah.
But it was so cool to be able to go up there and basically, there's a field trip that I went on, and when it's not damaged, they let you go look through the big 36-inch refracting telescope in the historic building.
Mm-hmm.
This is one of like the original telescopes on the mountain that people back when this was built. It was built in the late 1800s.
Mm-hmm.
Researchers were actually using that telescope in like the early 1900s to do cutting edge research.
So it's like touching history.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And they let you look through it.
Yeah.
It's so cool.
I've been to a couple of observatories. I can't remember. Like, I think I went to one maybe somewhere in, I want to say Spain. And yeah.
Ooh.
Just being able to go and see the things you can't see with the naked eye, to actually see the rings on planets and have them explain, like, oh, these two stars are circling one another. And I remember we were bouncing from telescope to telescope because mm-hmm. it was like, oh, the clouds have moved. Now we can see this. It was exciting. So mm-hmm. I love that. Why were you – was it a field trip?
Yeah, for a summer program I was at.
That is
so
amazing.
Cool.
Was everyone the same like you, just like giddy? Because I would have been.
I think so. I mean, all of us were in that summer program because mm-hmm. we wanted to do something with astronomy, something with space.
Okay.
I feel really fortunate because I not only went then, but I then emailed one of the support astronomers and went back up again a few months afterward.
Nice.
And they showed me the actual research telescopes that I now use.
Wow. Like,
I actually have time now on Lick Observatory on the big 3-meter telescope up there.
Wow, that's incredible. So speaking of time on the telescopes, tell our listening audience what it is you are currently researching.
Yeah, so I'm really interested in basically big, massive stars that explode at the end
Ooh.
Of their lives.
Who doesn't love a good explosion? Okay.
I know, right? So I'm really interested in basically trying to find these explosions, especially mm-hmm. the more rare ones and the really energetic ones, and following those explosions as they decay. So their light, it dims in luminosity over time.
So here's the thing, in our listening audience, we all know this. You can't just, you don't just stumble across an explosion. I'm guessing that these explosions are things that have already happened, or have you been lucky enough to go, hey, there's an explosion over there?
Yeah, that's basically how it works. So
really?
So we have these big wide field surveys.
Mm-hmm.
So like some people might be familiar with the Vera C. Rubin Observatory that's coming online as we speak.
Oh.
It's this big wide field observatory that's in Chile. And what it is doing already, they're just spinning up operations right now, is they have this big wide field camera and they point it at every patch of the sky.
Okay.
Almost every night. So yeah, basically tiling the entire sky.
Okay. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Over maybe they observe the same patch of sky once every week or so.
Okay.
And from that, you really can understand what changes in the sky.
Okay.
So, if a star happens to explode, the Rubin will pick it up within a week timescale. And that's
wow.
early enough that, we can figure out what's interesting and then start directing other observatories to look at that thing.
So you have a star that explodes, and in my mind, an explosion is sudden and vast. Do explosions work the same way in space that they do in, say, action movies, the way we understand it?
Yeah, I mean, the explosion will happen really fast.
Okay.
But
like over a few seconds? Or?
Yeah, but like stars are big, right?
Yeah.
So, these explosions, they occur in stars that are usually, they have to be around 10 times more massive than our sun.
Okay.
So that's, insanely big,
yeah.
right? So the light and the energy that gets produced from these explosions, it's not going to all fizzle out in a few seconds like, an explosion on Earth might.
Oh, okay. So how long can you observe an explosion?
Yeah, so for a typical supernova, it's going to, the light curve, so how bright it is going to rise to the peak brightness and then dim over, you know, maybe a couple month time scale.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, I guess because there's no air in space, or is it?
Well, I mean, it works gravity a little bit differently. There's also, so there will be the initial explosion that really takes like seconds.
Sure.
And then just like the aftermath. So it expands, it's still really hot. Mm-hmm. Hot things, you know, emit light.
Okay.
And these explosions, they're insanely hot. You know, they're hotter than almost anything on Earth, hotter even than the surface of the sun.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
we can't even comprehend.
I mean, yeah, I mean, I guess it does just get to be a big number.
Yeah.
It's something like tens of thousands of Kelvin. You know, we exist here. Room temperature is like 300 Kelvin, right?
So if these are so hot, do things vaporize or?
Yeah, I mean, the star itself is already essentially, I mean, not vaporized. We would call it a plasma.
Oh.
So plasma, it's fourth state of matter, right? We have solid, liquid, gaseous, and then plasma. Plasma is where things are so hot that, you know, how an atom is like a nucleus plus a bunch of electrons around it.
Yeah.
The electrons in a plasma are all not bound to the nucleus.
So it basically explodes the atoms.
Well,
or
yeah. There's definitely some atomic physics stuff going on as part of that explosion. You get a lot of fusion of atoms and everything. But, you know, this plasma stays really hot for a long time. You know, it's harder to, as you're saying, this is space we're talking about. So it's harder to dissipate the heat energy.
Mm-hmm.
The way that you dissipate it is by light.
Okay.
So the reason that, you know, these things get so bright, you know, in optically, visually, is because they're so hot.
Okay.
That's one reason.
Okay. So I'm thinking of you have an atom with the nucleus and the protons and neutrons, and they all kind of, are they separated, or are they, is it like they're tethered to it, or they just get completely blown away from, or just
you can think of it like a soup.
Okay.
So, you know, normal matter that, you know, we exist here on Earth and is, you know, the atoms are typically tethered to their electrons, right?
Yes.
Unless you, you know, rub your hands really hard together, you can dislodge some electrons.
Okay.
And then if you touch metal, right, that'll shock you.
Okay.
Because you've ionized some of the electrons
off.
In a plasma, it's so hot that all of those electrons are ionized off. So you've just got this big particle soup that's really hot.
And then do the electrons eventually find their way back to their original?
Really? As it cools off, yeah.
To their original, to like the
maybe
original,
not the original ones, but they'll recombine when it cools off enough.
Okay, all right. So you just got this sort of alphabet soup of protons and things
bouncing
around, and then some stray nucleus comes along, and as it cools down, it goes, I'll just plant myself here.
Yeah.
Wow. So in that huge plasma and that reconfiguration of atoms, do you get elements that didn't exist before?
Yeah.
Really?
So that's one of the interesting things that I actually like to study about supernovae.
Uh-huh.
So I'm interested in what we call nucleosynthesis, which is really you know, you get bigger atoms because it's hot enough that nuclei can actually push themselves together. So nuclei, you know, they're positively charged.
Okay.
Usually they don't like, you know, getting close to each other.
All right, yeah.
But when you have environments like that are so extreme in their temperatures and the densities, especially as part of an explosion, some of those nuclei can get pushed together and they fuse.
Mm.
So that's nuclear fusion or nucleosynthesis.
Yeah.
And that creates bigger atoms.
Wow. Does it create atoms that aren't on the periodic chart?
They're all on the periodic table.
Okay.
In fact, most supernovae can't even fuse together some of the bigger atoms in the periodic table.
Okay. So then my next question, because I know that our planet just sits sort of in the boondocks of the galaxy, and we think we know all of the elements that exist, but the universe is vast, so how do we know that there isn't more than just what's in our little, you know, in the boonies?
Yeah, I mean, it's theoretically possible, I think, that there can be more stable elements, meaning much heavier than the ones that we talk about on the periodic table.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is, once you get up to even, you know, really heavy elements that we know about, you know, even things that you might be able to talk about, like uranium, mm-hmm. not even some of the, you know, crazily named ones,
mm-hmm.
those things are very big. So one, they're really hard to make because they're so big. You know, uh-huh. you need a lot of pressure and temperature and the really, really specific environments to make those really big atoms in the first place.
Okay.
And second of all, you know, once you get up to those very big atoms, they're really radioactive.
Mm.
So they don't even stick around all that long. So, you know, maybe some heavier atoms exist somewhere out there.
Okay.
Maybe some of those atoms even exist on the Earth, but they exist in such small proportions that, you know, maybe we could find one. Maybe we could make one
with
the right, you know, giant particle accelerator. But like, it's one atom. Is it really going to be that useful for anything?
Right. All right. Now, this what you said triggered a question, because when I think of radioactivity, I had very bad science upbringing. So it's like radioactivity is the stuff that poisons you, and maybe in a science fiction movie will make giant ants and spiders. But in reality, what does it mean to be radioactive?
Yeah, so radioactivity really just means that so you have an atom, and it's not stable in its current configuration.
Sure.
So that means that really it wants to lose like a proton or a neutron.
Okay.
Usually, you know, there are a few different types of radioactivity, which, you know, you lose something different for each of those types. We don't have to get into those. But basically, the atom is unstable. It doesn't want to exist in its current configuration.
Okay.
It's more energetically favorable for it to exist as a smaller atom.
Okay.
So that's what causes that atom to, after some time scale, whether it's, you know, nanoseconds or years or billions of years, to, you know, cast off some of its neutrons and protons.
Then why? The next step is, why is radioactivity bad for humans? Is it because when it throws off those atoms, the atoms fuse with our atoms? Or?
Yeah, so those particles that the atom can slough off can be really energetic, and they can interact with our bodies and mess up all sorts of things. And also, if you get a really, you know, a big chunk of radioactive material, that's a lot of atoms, a lot of atoms that are continuously releasing particles. So there's a lot of particles that are interacting with you.
Oh, okay. So a radioactive thing that it's throwing off, even when it comes to your body, is still energetic, and is still, it's like a you know, I guess one of those games, the you know, like the pachinko or whatever, you know, that's just bouncing around, destroying cells in your body.
Yeah. So one type of particle that one type of radioactivity is just electrons. So if you get a bunch of, you know, free energetic electrons come in, those are things that are negatively charged. They can come in and interact with the atoms that make up you, and you know, do all sorts of weird things in your body.
Like kind of slice up the atoms that are in your body?
Yeah, I mean, I won't
figuratively
go too into medicine, because that's not the path that I went down with my education. But, you know, it's not good to have a bunch of you know, really energetic things. You know, it's like you can get a sunburn because you get a bunch of UV radiation that's centered on your skin. you can get a radiation burn, same kind of thing, from standing next to a, you know, chunk of uranium
for too long.
Just because so much stuff is interacting with your skin and messing up your cells.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to 89.5 FM KPOO San Francisco. I'm your DJ Marilyn, and we're speaking with Natalie LeBaron from the Wonderfest people, the Wonderfest crew. They are an amazing organization, and we're talking about exploding stars. And are stars the only thing that explode out in... Are there other things that explode?
Yeah, I mean... Mostly it's stars. There's other types of explosions. Most things involve stars in some way, at least that I care about.
Okay.
But it's not just, you don't just have to have a single star that explodes at the end of its life, for example. You might have, so another thing that... I study not as much as other people in my group, but it's data that I will take and things that I'm interested in is so at the center of our galaxy, there's this thing called a supermassive black hole.
Oh, okay.
So these black holes, you know, they're many millions to billions to even trillions times the mass of our sun.
Okay.
They're at the center of basically every galaxy.
Okay.
And sometimes a very unlucky star will get too close to the supermassive black hole at the center of a galaxy.
Okay, and then...
Not quite, actually. Oh, close.
Okay.
So usually they don't go straight into the black hole, but they get on some orbit around the black hole.
Okay.
And as that orbit decays, the star will get close enough to the black hole where the black hole will actually rip off... or start tidally pulling on the star. So that's like, you know, the moon causes tides on the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
It gravitationally attracts the water and some of the, you know, land on the Earth. Supermassive black hole will do that to a star, and it will make elongate the star along that gravitational axis.
Okay.
And eventually...
Like taffy?
Yeah, exactly.
Ah.
And eventually pull apart that star into pieces, basically, and stretch it around its whole orbit.
So then does that star just become like a coating for, you know, an additional coating, like sort of breaks down and now it's a candy shell or something?
Something like that, yeah. I'm, what we're interested in studying is when the debris from that star makes an entire orbit around, it will then crash into other parts of the star that, you know, were a little bit further away from the black hole.
Okay.
So they didn't get as stretched.
Okay.
And that will cause a big explosion.
Oh, so there's like these chain reactions because the star gets pulled close, like, is unfortunate, gets close to the nucleus, starts going around it, starts breaking apart, starts elongating, but the part that's not as close...
it won't be moving as fast because it's not as close in.
Okay.
So the debris that was going fast will catch up.
And crash into
it.
And then boom.
Yeah.
So does that happen along an axis or...
In like the plane of the disk.
Oh, okay. 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 So... then when it's this sort of taffy like substance, does it form like a ring around the planet as a taffy, or is it just kind of covering part of the nucleus?
Yeah, it'll be like a, you'll get like a ring around the supermassive black hole that's all the stellar debris that's been tidally pulled off of the star.
Okay. And does it act sort of like a sander? It's just sort of gradually sanding it to bits?
Maybe in some sense. I think of it more maybe like the taffy example that you were saying.
But at some point, it completely disintegrates.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, a lot of it will disintegrate in the explosion.
Mm-hmm.
But... some of the debris will also escape.
Now, is it a thing where more than one star might get pulled into the orbit at one time?
Maybe. if it's like a binary system, yeah.
Has that, do they know if that's happened or is that just a theory?
Not sure I could point to a specific example,
okay.
But I don't see why some of the ones that we've observed couldn't be binary systems.
Okay. So let's go back to, you've gridded out the sky, the universe for the telescope to look at different mm-hmm. pieces in an orderly fashion. You find something that's just exploded. You all fly into action. What does that action look like?
Lot of writing, actually.
Okay.
So every year, my whole group will sit down and we will write proposals to telescopes,
okay.
Basically asking them to give us time.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the time, we don't know what or when is going to explode,
sure.
Right? So a lot of the time we're asking for telescope time that we can then trigger once something has exploded.
Oh, okay.
So that usually happens before something explodes. Once something that's super interesting explodes,
mm-hmm.
We might want to write more telescope proposals,
okay.
To try and get, specific wavelengths or specific cadences of observation.
So when you talk about wavelengths and cadences, what are you talking about?
Yeah, so wavelength refers to the electromagnetic spectrum,
mm-hmm.
right? So we can see, a very small amount of light,
mm-hmm.
in the visible range, the rainbow. That's a very small wavelength range of the entire spectrum of electromagnetic light.
Okay.
Goes, from the most energetic gamma rays to the least energetic radio waves.
Mm-hmm.
And my group is really interested in looking at basically all colors of light from mm-hmm. gamma to radio and
okay.
everything in between. So we like to get time on a lot of different telescopes. And what was your other question?
Well, before I go to that, you talked about gamma rays and cadence, but
mm-hmm.
What does looking at those different wavelengths tell you, and then explain cadence and what that mm-hmm. tells you and how having that information furthers the understanding of the cosmos?
Yeah, so looking at every, basically every type of light that an object can produce
mm-hmm.
really gives you the complete picture of what is going on with something out there in the universe. So, we could just look at an explosion in visual, like optical light.
Okay.
But the temperatures are so big that most of the light isn't coming to us in the optical, usually.
Okay.
It's actually coming to us in UV wavelengths, ultraviolet.
Okay.
Or maybe potentially if it's really high energy, it might be even shorter wavelengths like X-rays.
Oh, okay.
So really seeing the entire spectrum of light gives you more of an idea of what physics is going on.
Oh, okay.
And what different types of material are in the way between, the explosion and us.
So is it telling you, like, what that star is made up of?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
What it's made of, what its energy is. You can even tell, like, how big it is,
mm-hmm.
how big the explosion is. All sorts of things.
So here on Earth, we're made up of everything that's in the periodic table, yes?
Mm-hmm.
Out in space.
Same thing.
Okay.
At least for the explosions.
So then are you do the explosions tell you how much it's made, like how much of this planet is helium, how much of this planet is...
Yeah, the star, yeah.
Oh, okay, sorry, how much of the star, okay. So typically what is a star made up of, or is there such a thing as a typical...
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, so stars on the whole are made up of hydrogen.
Oh, okay.
Some amount of helium, and then very, very small amounts of everything else,
okay.
Basically.
Okay. And are those small amounts of everything else just sort of random debris that gets fused when it becomes a star, or?
Yeah, so it's some combination of the stuff that the star formed out of.
Mm-hmm.
So, right, we have these big stellar nurseries. They, again, mostly just hydrogen, mm-hmm. some helium, mm-hmm. and then bits of everything else. And whatever that stellar nursery was made up of when the star forms, that will be the base amount of or base composition of that star. And then when it explodes, it will also fuse more elements together.
Okay.
Also, during its lifetime, the star will fuse hydrogen into helium and then helium into bigger elements and okay. so on.
Okay. Okay. So then now let's go back to what is cadence and how does cadence add to one's understanding of a star?
Yeah. So, you know, these are explosions, right? Mm-hmm. So they get bright and then they dim. Mm-hmm. And as they dim, you know, their evolution, their composition even, and other properties, like especially temperature, change with time.
Okay.
So really to get a good picture of how in one of these explosions evolve, you need to continually look at that explosion until it fades beyond, the sensitivity limit of your telescope.
Okay.
So cadence really just refers to how often are you getting observations.
Oh,
maybe
okay.
not every night, but, every week or something.
Okay. So you've been looking at stars now for how long in this research capacity?
Yeah, so I'm in my fourth year of grad school now.
Okay. So what is something that you learned, something that you didn't know before you started the research that you just found fascinating?
Oh, where do I even start?
You can talk about more than one, but, you know.
Well, I mean, I feel like I've learned so much through grad school, and I'm still learning a ton.
Okay.
But
or something that, like, rocked you, blew your socks off.
Well, something that I really like talking about and researching is actually that chemical nucleosynthesis,
uh-huh.
like how you even build bigger and bigger atoms through these types of explosions.
What's the biggest atom that you've seen thus far?
Well, I'm trying to look. If I can find the biggest atom I want to see, I would be very happy.
Uh-huh.
But typical supernovae, so these massive star explosions,
mm-hmm.
produce a lot of like iron, they produce a lot of magnesium,
mm-hmm.
Some of those sort of, you know, fairly heavy but not super heavy elements. These aren't, you know, big things like uranium.
Mm-hmm.
But something that I'm trying to figure out is whether there are certain types of supernovae that do produce really heavy elements like
okay.
gold or silver or platinum or even uranium, potentially.
Wow.
We know of a certain type of explosion, basically where you have two neutron stars, when they merge, we have observational evidence that they do produce uranium and gold
mm-hmm.
Through that explosion following the merger of these neutron stars.
Mm-hmm.
But that nucleosynthesis environment might not be the only place where that occurs in the universe. In fact, we know it's not the only place.
How do you know?
Well, we recently, some researchers found that there is evidence for this nucleosynthesis in these things called giant magnetar flares, which
Ooh,
are really
what are
those? Cool. Well, so neutron stars are these basically degenerate balls of matter.
Ooh,
right?
I like that. Degenerate yeah. balls of matter. That'll be my next band name. Go on.
It's a good band name. But so they're these big stars that they are really dense.
Mm-hmm.
So they're like the mass of the sun crammed into something the size of San Francisco.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, these things are incredibly dense.
Okay.
And so if you have two of these in a binary system, so giant magnetar flares.
Mm-hmm.
So a magnetar is one of these neutron stars. that is spinning really, really fast.
Okay.
And these, so they're these neutron stars, they're big balls of like, you know, charged material. So there's a lot of like neutrons or protons and electrons. And when they spin really fast, these charges create these giant magnetic fields.
Makes sense. Okay.
Right. So this is kind of like our sun.
Okay.
Right. It has magnetic fields and solar flares. And you can have the equivalent of a solar flare on a neutron star.
Ooh.
Which is basically what these giant magnetar flares are.
Okay.
So there's these big expulsions of charged material that come off of these big big spinning neutron stars.
Okay.
And in those flares, you can have this process that heavy nuclei can take on a bunch of neutrons.
From the flare?
Yeah.
Okay.
And then the neutrons are slightly unstable, so they decay into protons, making bigger elements.
Wow.
So that's how these giant magnetar flares can make things like gold.
Wow. That is very intense. So, and that is something that someone's just discovered.
Yeah.
In the last 10 years?
Last year, even.
Really?
I guess it was 2024.
Wow. Just like, boom, suddenly there's a new understanding of something that didn't exist when you first started school. I love things like that. So, this is going to seem like a really dumb question because it is, but
no dumb questions.
Oh yeah, there are. So when I think of atoms, I think of these things that you can only see through a microscope. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Now and then we talk about the atomic weight of an atom, but then you're talking about atoms getting heavier and heavier. Is philosophically, it feels like an atom would get to a point where it would be big enough to experience the weight of it even if you couldn't see it?
Not really. They're still too small for that.
Okay. So is there a limit to how many protons and electrons an atom can have?
Yeah, so, you know, our current understanding of stable nuclei is something, you know, a little bit more than, it's definitely going to be under 100 protons.
Okay.
And that's also going to have around the same number of neutrons also in that nucleus. So maybe, you know, under 300 nucleons in total making up a nucleus.
And if it's unstable, how many of the different pieces can it have? Because you're, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a nuclear physicist, so this is a little bit outside my wheelhouse, but you can at least try to push bigger and bigger nuclei together. But at some point, you know, even with these really big nuclei, it's really hard to push them together. Because you have so many protons that you're trying to push other protons to. You know, like charges repel.
Okay.
So this big ball of protons really doesn't want more protons coming near it.
But couldn't that happen with the, you talked about the plasma state where it's everything is, but then the plasma state, they're actually separating. So I guess.
No, that's electrons. So that's different than the nuclei.
Okay.
I mean, in theory, it can happen, but it probably won't happen in large proportion because, these nuclei really don't want to exist close to each other. Mm-hmm. So you're going to have a really hard time, even under such extreme conditions, making bigger nuclei.
Okay.
You already have a hard time making, you know, big normal atoms, like even
it's hard enough just to make a normal atom, much less like a super atom.
Yeah, something off the periodic table.
Frankenstein atom. Okay, well, let's go back to your research. So you've gridded up the map of the cosmos. You found a sector where something has recently exploded. You guys start writing furiously. What are some of the things that have come out in the preliminary studies of these explosions?
Yeah, so I guess maybe I can talk about the most recent cool object
that
we've discovered and actually published something on.
Okay.
And if you want to read more about it, we've put out some press about this explosion quite recently, actually.
Okay.
So this was an explosion of, well, we don't quite know what it is, which is really cool and makes us really excited because we want to learn what it is.
Okay.
So this thing exploded October, not of last year, but of the year before.
2024. Okay.
And, well, this was the, like, the 12th explosion of its kind.
Oh.
So we really don't understand what these things are that well. But this one was really cool because it is the most luminous explosion of its class.
Okay.
So that means it got really, really bright.
Does that mean it was really, really big to be so
bright? Okay. Because actually we think it's a lot more massive than the others of its class. Which again is really cool because if something's really bright, then we can get a lot more data on it.
Okay.
And follow it for a longer time period.
And you call it one of 12, but it's one of 12 things you don't know what it is, or one of is it one of the 12 same things that you guys have?
Yeah.
Okay.
So the class of objects is called FBOTS.
FBOTS.
These are fast blue optical transients.
Okay.
Kind of describes what it is. So they're fast. So they peak and they decay in light much faster than normal supernovae. So within, you know, 10 days, they'll peak and they'll fall off within another 10 days.
Oh, okay. So you have a short window of time. So you guys are lucky you discovered it at all.
Yeah.
Okay.
So they're fast. They're blue. So, right, they're blue in color. They emit more in like ultraviolet than in red wavelengths. So fast blue optical, so optical, visual light, but they emit in many different parts of the spectrum. So they actually also emit X-rays and radio waves, and they also emit in the infrared, which is very cool. So yeah, fast blue optical transients.
Okay.
So that's... you know, a descriptor of what we see, but...
But you guys don't actually know what it is?
Intrinsically, yeah.
Oh, okay. You don't... Isn't it just another star?
Well, that's a great question.
Ah, you don't know.
Because they...
You really don't know.
Because they peak and decay so fast, it's really hard to, you know, conceive of this being like a normal supernova.
Okay.
You know, normal supernovae, they peak and decay over, you know, a month, couple month time scale. So we think that there has to be some different kind of physics involved.
Right.
Maybe not, well, at least a different kind of environment, right?
Because it happens so fast relative to all the other things you've ever seen. You're like, well, maybe it's not a star. Maybe it's some weird... thing that you guys don't know about?
Well, I mean, we have some ideas.
What are those ideas?
Really hard to pin down which of them. So,
what are some of the contestants?
Well, the thing that we sort of are leaning to, but it's still kind of open, is that, well, if you have a star and a black hole orbiting each other.
Okay.
So this would be like a pretty small black hole, like stellar mass.
Right.
Mass of our sun.
Not enough to pull it, to taffy it, but enough to keep it together. Okay.
Yeah, well, if that companion star gets close enough to the black hole, it can get taffied and ripped apart.
Okay.
And we think that something like that might actually... cause these kind of transients.
Okay, so that's one theory. What are some of the other theories?
Other theories include, well, maybe it's some weird type of explosion, or maybe it's some kind of failed supernova, like the supernova doesn't actually explode, it just immediately collapses somehow.
Okay. Like a false alarm, like
yeah, something like that.
Okay.
But my group's pretty interested in it being some kind of tidal disruption event, which is the taffy thing.
Okay. What, and so you talk about your group, but we haven't actually said who your group is and where do you do your research?
Yeah, so I'm a graduate student at UC Berkeley.
Go Bears.
In the astronomy department.
Okay.
Go Bears. I work with Raffaello Margutti, who's a professor in the astronomy department.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. And so you have you've seen this crazy explosion of the F-bots, which I kind of love that. That might be my new band name. but so you see these crazy explosions, and did you stumble across it, or like it was, were there any indications that there was going to be an explosion? It just suddenly, boom, there it is in sector 128B12 or something.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about these rare transients, like even supernovae, you know, you can't, well, for one, they usually happen so far away that it's not like you really can tell even what star exploded, right?
Mm-hmm.
The galaxy is so far away that you can't make out individual stars. But even in, you know, if you had a supernova in a nearby galaxy or like the LMC or something, or satellite galaxies mm-hmm. around our galaxy, you might be able to see the star. You might have a sense that, yeah, this star is reaching the end of its life, but you don't know exactly when it's going to explode, right?
Sure.
Because it's all about the stuff that's happening internally to the star, and you can't see that, right?
Exactly.
There's a whole star in front of it.
About a gajillion miles away, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So if people wanted to find out more about the research that you are doing right now, how would they go about doing that?
Well, we just put out some press on this FBOT. So
yes.
If you look up my name, Natalie LeBaron, mm-hmm. and either FBOT, or you can look up, we put the press out through Berkeley as well as through a bunch of the observatories
mm-hmm.
that we use to follow up this object. So like Keck Observatory, Gemini Observatory, Chandra, they all have their own press releases, and you can read a little bit about the work that we did.
Okay. And then when little kids ask you what you do, how do you explain it to them?
Oh, well, I feel like most people know what an astronomer is.
Yeah.
But, you know.
But what you do?
I'm an observer.
Okay.
I really enjoy observing. So operating telescopes, right? So
mm-hmm.
I stay up all night and I look at the sky and I try and understand what's going on up there, mostly with the explosions.
Excellent. And again, we come back to who doesn't love a good explosion?
I know, right?
Well, Natalie, we're almost out of time. So is there anything you would like our listening audience to know before we sign off?
Well, if you're interested in astronomy and you're local to Berkeley, in April through November, we do monthly astronomy nights for the public.
Ooh.
On Thursday evenings.
Mm-hmm.
It's usually right before sunset. You can also Google that, Berkeley Astronomy Night.
Berkeley Astronomy Night. I love it.
Come on by.
All right. Well, Natalie LeBaron, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me, Marilyn.
Okay, people of Earth, you heard it here first. It's the F-Bots. If you ever hear of a band called F-Bots, you know it's going to be me. We're just about out of time. We're going to turn the mic over to Mr. Ford. It'll be pleasuring your ear hole. I'm going to leave you in this brand new year with a little bit of Scott Bradley's Postmodern Jukebox. And on of our guest, this, my friends, is Black Hole Sun. Until next week, my friends, ta-ta and toodly-doo.
In my eyes, in despair.